From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, what's going to happen to Sacramento Zoo? Will it move, and if so, where? Or will it make the most of its small current location in Land Park? Also, author and former psychotherapist Amy Bloom, and evaluating the health of people from ancient Rome based on how symmetrical their skulls are. We start with another medical topic, but this one concerns robots, not ancient times, specifically the use of a robot to treat a heart problem that until recently needed medication. A Sacramento hospital has just started using this robot-assisted technique. It's for treating afibrillation, an abnormal rhythm of the heart. Joining us is a man who's using this system. He's Dr. Garode O'Neill, Medical Director of the Cardiac Electrophysiology Laboratory at Mercy General Hospital. Garode, welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Tell us, what does this robot look like?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, it looks like a large box of metal. Did you ever see that movie, Number 5?
No, I have not.
It looks like Number 5. We should give it a name, like Number 4. It's actually it's a device that allows us to transmit manual activity from a distance. So it's not really an artificial intelligence-type robot, which I hope we get to eventually. Right now, basically, it transmits physical actions on the part of the operator, but we can do it remotely. And the big advantage of a device such as this is it allows us to operate on the patient without exposing the staff or ourselves to excessive radiation. And it's a much more ergonomically attractive way to do things rather than standing all the time at the bedside. We can sit down like you are now, I am here, and do our procedure in relative comfort.
So you're not actually directly in contact with the patient when the procedure is happening?
Well, anything that happens to the patient is happening because of the movements I make, but I'm making them remotely.
Yes. So, and whereabout is the robot then? Is that actually in the operating?
It's actually, it could be outside, but there is a safety issue as well, because just in case something happens suddenly, one needs to be able to intervene. So we have it set up so we're about 20 feet removed from the actual patient's bedside.
What's this robot called?
The one we're using is manufactured by a company out of Mountain View called Hansen, and it's called the Sensei, S-E-N-S-E-I. And Hansen robot, but in light of this discussion, I'm going to call it Number 4.
Okay. My guest is Dr. Garode O'Neill of Mercy General Hospital. We're talking about a new robotic-assisted system for doing a heart procedure. Tell us more about this problem of afibrillation. What is it?
Well, actually, that's a very apropos topic, given that this is Heart Month as well. Atrial fibrillation is the single most common abnormality of the electrical system that we deal with. And it actually has major implications for the health of the community. What may not well be recognized is that it is the single principal cause of people developing a stroke. And it's particularly important in older folks for that reason. What happens essentially is that the top chambers of the heart beat very rapidly, so rapidly in fact, that they can no longer transmit a coordinated contraction. As a result of this, blood may stagnate and clot within the heart chamber and then dislodge, go down the circulation. And then it's like playing pinball or pinball, whatever. It just bounces into the brain cells and stops the circulation, causes a stroke. There have been a lot of developments in the very recent past as to how we can manage it. The old standard was to use an anticoagulant, a blood thinning drug called Coumadin or warfarin, to keep the blood from clotting.
But that can have its own problems.
Absolutely.
I know my mother was on warfarin, had to have an operation, and she had to delay the operation for several days while she got off the warfarin.
Exactly right. And not only that, because it is an anticoagulant, it creates problems with bleeding. Now, a new drug has been released that has some advantages vis-a-vis Coumadin, particularly with respect to the time you have to stop it and the need for monitoring and so on. But it doesn't really take care of the fundamental problem. And what we're trying to address really is the fundamental problem. How can you fix or cure atrial fibrillation? How can you control the rhythm in the first place?
And does this technique actually cure it, or is it just a better way of treating it?
Well, there are a number of ways of treating it. You can use medications, for instance, to control it, which are marginally effective. You can actually use surgical techniques. And the technique we're using with catheters is also effective in a sizable number of patients, but not all.
My guest is Dr. Garode O'Neill of Mercy General Hospital. How do people react when you tell them, or at least suggest to them, that you're going to use this black box that we're calling number four, on their heart?
Well, I think people who have the condition, first of all, we keep people very well informed of the new developments. So our patients, by the time they reach the laboratory, are very well educated as to the alternatives available. I think most patients will willingly accept a technique that will contribute to their safety and the safety of the staff without any negative implications for themselves. And so far, that's the findings that we have.
But do people need any reassuring, though, that there is a doctor still involved?
Yes. Well, there is a doctor involved, obviously, yes. And there are usually more than one physician in the room at the time. I think reassurance is a very important part of the whole treatment. You know, people have to have confidence in what you're doing if you're going to have a successful outcome. And it hasn't been an issue of people reacting negatively. Most of the activities within cardiology at the moment tend to be fairly high tech.
How new is this technique?
Well, first of all, the technique for treating atrial fibrillation surgically just goes back to the 1980s. And catheter-based techniques really just took off in 1998, so it's quite recent. The advent of robotic technology is a new phenomenon again. The first examples being executed probably about 2005 or so. So it's a relatively new technology.
And this is very new at Mercy?
It's brand new at Mercy. We've just installed the equipment in the last couple of months.
And how many patients have you treated, and did it all go well?
It has gone very well so far, and we have started basically doing relatively simple cases so that we're convinced of our own skills with the device. We plan to expand into the more complicated arrhythmias in the next couple of weeks. And so far, so good. We're very excited about this.
Yeah. You said earlier that this is not an AI or artificial intelligence robot, but you're hoping that that will come down the line. What do you mean by that?
Well, the holy grail as far as treatment of this condition is concerned would be to basically program in a set of instructions to the computer and to tell it what to do. And we could sit back and have a glass of coffee or a glass of water, a cup of coffee or what have you, and let the machine do its thing. Now, theoretically, this is possible. The problem is the variations in physiology that are ongoing all the time. Remember, we are dealing with a heart that's moving, beating, you hope. Inside a chest that's breathing, you hope.
Yeah.
And whereas the images that we take to guide our paths tend to be static images. One of the advantages of this system we have is it has a pressure sensor that allows us to measure the amount of pressure the catheter is placing against the wall. So what I hope by an artificial intelligence design would be a device that could integrate all this information itself and then with a preset set of instructions, go ahead and create the surgical set of, we call them lesions, but lines or burns to achieve the objective.
How far down the line do you think that is?
I think it's probably 5-10 years away. There are competing technologies coming out. Even better than this would be to come up with a system that would allow us to cure the problem without invading the human body at all, non-invasively. And there are some experiments being done along those lines right now.
But if you follow that technological path just a little further, what role is there for the Garrod O'Neills of the future?
Well, first of all, we will have to make the diagnosis. We'll have to help guide the patients through these things. And maybe our role will become less involved in terms of the actual technicalities of doing the procedure. But that's not necessarily a bad thing if we get better outcomes.
Let's get back to atrial fibrillation, the condition that's being treated by this new system. Do you know you have it when you have it?
Well, if I could just for a second.
Please.
It's not just atrial fibrillation. We treat a variety of arrhythmias as well.
Okay.
Atrial fibrillation probably now is the most common. Do you know you have it? It depends. Not everyone will, in fact. The symptoms that people experience with this condition are highly variable. It's very interesting that some older folks can have no symptoms at all or relatively non-specific symptoms like fatigue or dizziness or what have you. It tends to be a fact that the younger people experience more and complain more about it. They're the ones that will tell you, oh my goodness, my heart is racing very, very rapidly, or I nearly fainted. Some people are so disabled by this that they can't go to work in the morning. So there's a whole spectrum of symptoms that go along with the condition.
Now, when you say younger people, do you mean down to children?
Rarely seen in children. 20s, 30s are relatively infrequent. In fact, there's a linear graph that goes along with age. So the older you are, the greater the probability. So, it's less common in young people, but when young people get it, they tend to be bothered more by it.
And you said that the greatest risk that comes from this, even though it's a heart condition, and people, when they hear heart condition, they worry about heart attacks and so on. You said that it's a stroke. It might be the biggest concern.
Well, really, it is the biggest concern. And there are other factors that come into this whole concept of general health. For instance, the people that are most at risk are those that are over 75, have high blood pressure, and are diabetic, and maybe have weakening of the heart muscle and heart failure symptoms as well. So it's all the things together that create the increased risk of stroke. So if we treat atrial fibrillation, you still cannot ignore the other problems. You still need to treat the hypertension appropriately. You still need to treat the diabetes appropriately, because all of these things together increase the risk of having a stroke.
But what about the underlying arrhythmia? Is that just a genetic roulette wheel that decides whether you have it, or are there lifestyle issues involved?
Well, there are lifestyle issues to a degree. For instance, one of the things that's recently been recognized is the importance of sleep apnea.
That's where you snore badly and wake yourself up
briefly.
Right.
Yeah, well, you hope you wake up. Or your wife tells you, hey, you quit breathing for 30 seconds or a minute or so. There's clearly a very, very strong correlation between sleep apnea and atrial fibrillation. So one needs to treat sleep apnea if you have it as well. But I'm sorry, what was the other point you were making?
I think you were dealing... Well, I had asked you about... I'm not sure that I can necessarily recreate my question, but I had asked you about the... you know what? I've completely spaced on it because I've got something else going on right now that's also distracting me.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
That's quite okay.
But you know, the sleep apnea obviously is one of the things that is associated with it. We talked about treating the diabetes, treating heart failure, and so on. And all these things tend to be less applicable in younger folks. Therefore, the statistical risk of stroke is much less in the younger person. But as you mentioned earlier on regarding the complications of blood thinners, they tend to be more serious in older folks. And one of the big dilemmas we often encounter is, what do we do with the very elderly patient who we think is at a risk of a fall, but also is at a risk of having a stroke from atrial fibrillation? So we have to balance these two competing risks, and it can be very challenging at times.
And finally, you're the medical director of the cardiac electrophysiology laboratory. What does that mean, electrophysiology?
Well, cardiology has become so subspecialized that we've brought it into two broad categories. The people that do the angioplasty stenting, we call them the plumbers, and the people who deal with the electrical problems or rhythm problems, which is the kind of work I do, we call the electrophysiologists. So basically, our lab is dedicated to treating people with abnormal heart rhythms, either too fast, too slow, or too irregular.
Dr. Garode O'Neill, Medical Director of the Cardiac Electrophysiology Laboratory at Mercy General Hospital in Sacramento, where they're now using a robotic-assisted system for treating arrhythmia in the heart. Garode, thanks for joining us.
Jeffrey, thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. When we come back, another medical story, figuring out how healthy people were in ancient times by measuring and comparing their skulls. Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Earlier in the show, we heard about the use of robots to treat hearts. Now here's another health story, but we're looking back in time to people who are already dead, figuring out how healthy people were in ancient times, not through their words or health records, but by examining their skulls. It turns out there's a connection between the symmetry of a skull and the overall health of the person. This evening at Sacramento State, Professor of Anthropology Samantha Hens will be giving a talk about all this. Her talk is called About Face, Using Symmetry to Measure the Health of Ancient Romans. She's in our studio. Samantha Hens, welcome to Insight.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
Why would there be a connection between the symmetry of a skull and the health of the person whose skull it is?
Well, generally what we see is the human or all organisms, animals as well as other humans, try to develop symmetrically. And this is what would be considered normal development. And some things from the environment can affect that, like poor nutrition or disease, infection, parasites. Even things like maternal smoking or obesity can affect the developing fetus or eventually the child as they're growing. And these environmental insults can kind of come in and affect that symmetric trajectory that the body is growing on, and it'll cause minor deviations or fluctuations from this perfect symmetry, and that tells us, when we see this asymmetry, that the individual had suffered some environmental stress during development.
Does that mean, then, that in the absence of any negative health influences, a skull would be symmetrical?
Yes, it does. Yes. We would expect that the, you know, your left ear would develop like your right ear, your left eye like your right eye, etc. And you will see that throughout the body. There is asymmetry that's normal, like we call directional asymmetry, which, you know, when people are right-handed, their right arm and muscles and such are usually larger than their left arm and stronger. And most people experience this in their daily life. But the kind of asymmetry I'm looking at is something called fluctuating asymmetry, which is random and not based on overuse.
How often, if ever, do you see 100% symmetry?
That would be rare. It is possible, but it's rare. Yeah, actually, not very often.
Have you seen it, though?
Not myself. Yeah, heard about it, but not seen it myself.
How could that be, that someone could be 100% symmetrical? How could anyone have a complete absence of negative health influence?
Well, with proper diet, proper nutrition, and there's also an underlying genetic ability that is in all organisms to strive, you know, that will promote you genetically to develop symmetrically. And that's something called canalization, kind of a big complicated term for a basic process. But when an individual is canalized and they have this strong genetic component, that'll maintain this, what we call developmental homeostasis, or this true symmetry. And so when you see the asymmetries, it could be environmental insult, could be a little bit of a genetic weakness, and indicating that if you have an asymmetry, maybe you're not quite as healthy as your more symmetric counterparts.
How would people react to someone that had a perfectly symmetrical skull? Would they look gorgeous to us? Would they look freaky or something else?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when we have shown some other studies, not so much in my field, but in psychology and such, they've shown pictures of perfectly symmetrical faces and then faces that are just slightly off, slightly asymmetrical. And they ask people to choose which one they think is more attractive, and they always choose the more symmetrical face.
I see. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, what's the least symmetrical skull that you've seen? Is it something you can express in a percentage?
Generally, the asymmetries that I'm looking at are tiny. You know, they're within just millimeters apart. You could have much larger asymmetries, like I said, due to directional asymmetry. For example, if you always chew on the right side of your mouth instead of the left side, the muscles on the right side will be larger of your face, and you'll actually see that developed in, you know, in the skull, that the bones will have larger dimensions there. So when you start getting into the fluctuating stuff, though, it's going to be more asymmetric, and you're not always going to see only the left side or only the right side asymmetric.
My guest is Samantha Hens, professor of anthropology at Sacramento State. Is it just skulls where this shows up, or could you do it any part of the body, but you just have chosen skulls?
Actually, you can do it anywhere. Skulls have really not been studied much at all. Most of the work has been on the rest of the body. And what's been done on the head has really been a lot of dental work, a lot of teeth. So skulls have been studied literally two or three, maybe four times in ancient populations. And so part of the reason my work is innovative, and I was asked to lecture this evening, is to talk about what can we learn from the skull. And one of the things we're looking at was trying to determine, are there regions of the skull where you're more likely to see asymmetry versus regions where you're less likely to see asymmetry, you know,
and
where they're conservative areas.
And are there?
Yes, definitely. You're more likely to see asymmetries in the face, up in the brain case, along the side of the skull, you know, above the ears. But you really see virtually none in the base of the skull. And it's interesting because in the base of the skull, there's a lot of tiny holes. They're called foramina. And through those holes pass blood vessels, nerves, really important vessels. And we see virtually no asymmetry there. So we call that a genetically conservative region, where you wouldn't want to have fluctuations in that region where you've got important vessels passing through. But, you know, if your palate is slightly crooked, it's not too big of a deal.
What have you found, generally speaking, in the people of ancient Rome? How healthy were they?
Actually, surprisingly very healthy.
Really?
We'll be discussing three populations tonight. Two of them are along the coast, and these are ports where a lot of ships and such trading were coming in. And in one case, a lot of the materials being shipped upriver to Rome. And my third site is an inland population, and they were actually of a lower socioeconomic class, kind of heavy laborers. They were involved in producing salt, actually, salt mining and salt production. And we weren't quite sure what to expect because we have different diets for these three populations, along with different economic regimes. The one population were shipbuilders. The other population, as I said, were the salt producers, heavy laborers. The other population was craftsmen and shopkeepers and traders, so more affluent. So we expected differences in the health of these three people, and we did actually find that along the coast where they had access to fish and shellfish and marine resources, high protein component, these people were healthier than some of the people located further away off the trade routes.
But it sounds like, generally speaking, they were more healthy than you expected.
Yes, indeed. And I think it's in part because at this time period, the first to third centuries AD, you've got the Imperial Roman Empire. It was doing very, very well at the time. This is early on before the fall of Rome, which came a couple hundred years later. And there was a lot of trade coming into the region. There's a very good agriculture in the area. Where we see a lot of deaths actually came from malaria. So a lot of the people dying young were stricken by malaria and not kind of long-standing, you know, nutritional or infectious disease.
My guest is Samantha Hens, professor of anthropology at Sacramento State, and she speaks there tonight. Her talk is titled About Face, Using Symmetry to Measure the Health of Ancient Romans, specifically measuring the symmetry of people's skulls. Do you find yourself looking at people's faces and heads to see how symmetrical they are?
I have to admit, yes, I do. One of the slides that I'll be showing tonight is my own face, and agonized about whether or not to actually show that, because you can actually see the asymmetries in my own face. You know, one eye squints a little bit more than the other and such. And I drew a line right through the middle so the audience members will be able to see just regular asymmetry. And you will start looking at each other and noticing it.
And can you tell from looking at someone's skull if one eye is a little differently located than the other? What can you tell from that? Or can you just tell overall this person was very healthy, somewhat healthy, so on?
If you look very critically, you will see, you know, there's changes, say, in the eye, or maybe one nostril is larger than the other, something like that in a living human. Sometimes it's quite obvious, and sometimes it's very hard. Some people are very, very symmetrical. So it's kind of interesting. With the skull, it's going to be significantly more difficult because you don't have the soft tissue there to kind of help you out.
What about people today? Would there be a benefit to doctors to measure how symmetrical their patients' skulls are?
Well, we do see this quite a bit in clinical settings, actually. There's been some measures of symmetry with children that suffer from something called cranial synostosis, which is a premature closure of the bones in the skull, the cranial sutures. And they try to take a look, are they developing on the same, you know, yeah, the left and right sides, you know, fusing at the same rate.
But that's a skull condition. What mm-hmm. about a general look at someone's health?
Nothing that I'm aware of as of yet in a modern population, not with humans anyway. It's becoming bigger in conservation biology. For example, that you can study, you know, living birds. And there was a study done on thrush birds in East Africa by some biologists. And they discovered that as the forest fragment became more degraded, the birds showed more asymmetry in their dimensions. So these were living animals that they could, you know, capture and measure and then re-release.
Yes.
And they noticed that if this asymmetry became severe, it indicated that there might be an influence on the lifespan of the birds. So as the more degraded the forest fragment became, the worse the asymmetry was. If we could catch this in advance, this could be a really telling sign for species that are in trouble.
And I guess one thing that ancient Romans and birds have in common is that we can't ask them what's up with them, whereas with modern-day patients, we can ask them. And
exactly.
So I guess there's less need to measure the skull from
exactly.
that point of view.
Yeah.
And finally, Samantha, how do you do this? How do you take an ancient Roman skull and measure the symmetry?
Actually, it's kind of a nice segue from your last segment that you had. I use a device called a three-dimensional digitizer, and it's sort of like a robotic arm. And it measures points on the skull that I chose in advance, and it'll look at all linear dimensions. So I take basically coordinate data like X, Y, Z on a graph, and I can model the skull in three dimensions and then look at all possible distances between those points that I've chosen. And then compare left and right sides.
So you don't have a ruler out and sticking it up against the skull.
No, a little more high tech. Yeah, a little more high tech and significantly more complicated to analyze.
Samantha Hens will be talking more about this tonight at 6 at the Sacramento State University Union. Her talk is part of the STEM Scholars Lecture Series. She's a professor of anthropology at Sacramento State. Samantha Hens, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, what's going to happen to Sacramento Zoo? Will it move? And if so, where? You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. There's more about our show on our webpage, capradio.org/insight, including links to follow our show on Facebook and me on Twitter. Tomorrow, the fraying of the healthcare safety net in the Central Valley City. We had planned to do that topic today and had promoted it, but it's been moved till tomorrow. And also later this week, we'll talk with Neil Conan, host of NPR's Talk of the Nation, who's in Folsom this weekend. What's going to happen to Sacramento Zoo? It's hemmed in at its current, relatively small site at Land Park, but possible destinations like Sutter's Landing, a former landfill, and the current site of Arco Arena all present their own problems. The zoo and the city of Sacramento are doing a years-long study of the situation and alternatives, and they'll air all this at a public workshop today. We're going to find out more about what's happening in all this with two guests from the city, but we'll start with Mary Healy, who's director and CEO of the Sacramento Zoo. Mary, welcome back to Insight.
Well, thank you very much, Jeffrey.
Remind us, what's the issue with the current site in Land Park? Why not just say this is where we are and we're going to stay?
Well, actually, you've just stolen my bottom line, because that is what we are looking at now. We did talk about land banking, and we formed a committee back in 2003 to look at a future site. But over the last 7 or 8 years, we've realized that that's not going to be an easy solution. For one thing, it's very costly. The economy was in a lot better shape 7 or 8 years ago when we started looking. But also, in addition, we've really stepped back and taken another look at our Land Park site. And our board of directors have made the commitment now to keep this Land Park site accredited by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums for the next 20 years. And we feel that there's some key things that if we can put them in place at the Land Park site, we hopefully will be successful even beyond that 20 years. But we are not moving. We are looking, refocusing on Land Park and really looking at what we can do here.
And when was this decision made?
Over the last year, because of the city's feasibility study, the city paid for a study of Sutter's Landing. And as that was going on and we realized that that was not going to be a viable alternative, our board of directors had a series of meetings to face that reality, the reality of not finding another site, the reality of the cost of building a new zoo. And we also had some encouragement from the Land Park Community Association. They went through some changes, and they were more receptive to talking to us about how the zoo could stay in Land Park. They were very concerned if we would move, what might happen. And so we decided to take the time last year to really explore our options for this site.
Mary Healy, director and CEO of the Sacramento Zoo. Also on the phone is J.P. Tyndall, who's park planning and development manager for the city of Sacramento. J.P., welcome.
Thank you, Jeff.
Is the city of Sacramento okay with this decision that the Sacramento Zoo is going to stay in place?
Yes. I mean, it's certainly a very popular city park. Land Park is actually our largest regional park and our most popular, most favorite place for people to go is in our park system. I think the issue is, you know, for us to speak with the zoo about next has to do with, you know, what if anything they feel is necessary to be more successful for another 20 years at Land Park, and that discussion has yet to take place.
Well, I realize it's a moot point given the decision that's been made, but would the city have liked the zoo to move somewhere else?
You know, it's an interesting question. I mean, we really take our direction on this issue from our elected officials, and today is a very good opportunity to spend some lengthy time hearing from the staff who have been working on this, you know, and the zoo folks who've been working on it even longer than some city staff people have.
Yes. Well, it sounds like the Sacramento Zoo has made its decision. Is there a decision for the city to make?
Yes, and it's not a decision that's yet been made.
And what is that decision?
Well, it would be, you know, to what extent, if at all, the city could support the idea of making some changes to Land Park so that the zoo could be more sustainable in that location.
Yes. In our studio is Scott Mandy, who's new growth and infill manager for the city of Sacramento. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here, Jeffrey.
The study that was done for the zoo and the city focused on Sutter's Landing, this former landfill site that's now being turned into a park, but it's still a work in progress. What's the problem with Sutter's Landing? I mean, there was a lot of focus on it. Why is the zoo not moving there?
Well, essentially, the Sutter's Landing Regional Park was a former municipal landfill that operated from the 1920s until about 1993. When it was closed, the thought was, well, let's see what we can do with it. It normally takes 20 or more years for the land to finish settling. So if you try to build anything on an unsettled landfill, you get differential settlement, which causes foundations and structures to crack. So there was the issue of trying to build on an unconsolidated landfill. Then you also have the fact that there's normally a cap over a landfill, and with a cap, you cannot penetrate it, meaning if you're going to plant trees and exotic species that really decorate a zoo, the botanic nature of it, then you get you can't do that. So you have to put it all in containers. You have to have subsurface drainage. That adds substantially to the cost. It's about a $30 million premium in the construction cost for a zoo.
I've been to Sutter's Landing Park, and there's a large fenced-off area with what appear to be vents in it. Are those letting off gases from the landfill as it continues to transition into not being a landfill?
Correct. That's actually the most recently closed portion of the landfill, and that is gas that is being vented, methane gas. The portions to the west were closed earlier, but they're also still in the process of settling, and that's where you'll see the handball court, the dog parks, and so on.
Mary Healy, are you and others at the zoo disappointed that these other locations, possible destinations, including Sutter's Landing Park, are not going to work out?
Well, we wanted to do the work, and we wanted to find out if there were other options. Because of the changing economy, even if we could have set land aside now, we wouldn't be in a position to build for quite some time. So I think it's working out for the best. And when I say we're not going to move, that's the decision for now, that we want to try to make the best of the Land Park site. But obviously the focus of the workshop today is to get feedback from City Council and from the public who will be there to get their thoughts on that as well. But it's certainly something that we feel that for right now, we're not, the society, the nonprofit society, is not in a position to take on building a zoo at a new site.
Well, what if what if there was a strong sentiment at the meeting, either from the public or from city elected officials or both, saying, we really want you to move somewhere else? How would the zoo react to that?
I think knowing that the reality of a new zoo to build from the ground up is about $1.5 million to $2 million an acre. So even if we were talking about something double our size, people would have to also be prepared to talk about where that kind of money would come from. So I think that would be a very interesting part of the discussion if people did feel passionately about us moving.
What kind of changes would you now be looking at making at the Land Park location?
We have a couple of opportunities here that we really think will set us up for success. One being a whole new front entrance complex to modernize the look of the zoo, much more contemporary, but also a much more functional front entrance. I think it's safe to say we're probably one of the few zoos in the country that does not have restrooms at the front entrance of the zoo, something that's very practical and very necessary. But we'd also like to have a much more efficient front entrance and add an animal exhibit up at the front to add to the area. Another exciting idea is the concept of a round-trip train ride from Old Sacramento to the zoo. The tracks stop right by our back fence, and it's something that's been talked about for a number of years and is very, very tantalizing when you see just how close those tracks are. And if people parked in Old Sacramento and took a round-trip train ride, it would actually help with the parking challenges, too.
It seems kind of odd that the train goes almost all the way to the zoo, but not quite.
That's right. That's why it's so tantalizing. Mm.
J.P. Tyndall, is the city open to any expansion of the current footprint of the zoo and land park?
Well, I think we're open to, you know, all proposals and have to really be speaking with the community and with our electeds further. You know, there's a big spectrum of views about the zoo, and any expansion, I think, is certainly going to have some impacts. And the question is, you know, are those impacts that can be mitigated in some way or minimized? Or are there any other really creative thinking we could do that will make something happen and not have negative consequences for anyone?
And Scott Mendy, what does this mean for Sutter's Landing Park? Because when I looked at the consultant's report analyzing possible destinations for the Sacramento Zoo, the Sutter's Landing site, the zoo, would have been a very important part of Sutter's Landing Park. That's not going to happen now. It certainly looks that way. What does that mean for Sutter's Landing Park in the vicinity? Where will the investment come from to really make the most out of that location?
The city still has an interest in developing Sutter's Landing as a regional park. If it won't be a zoo, it'll have to be something that's more open space oriented, something that requires fewer structures, but we'll probably still at some point have to provide better access into the site. Right now, you can only get there from the 28th Street going over the heavy rail tracks. Ultimately, we need to build a road. In the meantime, it'll just be more of a neighborhood-type park with river access.
Wouldn't it also need freeway access from Business 80?
Not necessarily. I think what you'd want to do is, if you are going to have a regional attraction which brings in people who are not familiar with Sacramento, then you need to provide convenient wayfinding. It doesn't have to be an interchange with the freeway, but at least convenient access to the freeway.
But that would require people to drive through residential areas, the eastern, northeastern part of Midtown, to get into Sutter's Landing, wouldn't they? To go up 28th Street.
At present, but our long-term plan is to build a parkway, essentially an arterial that connects from Richards Boulevard at Highway 160 in the direction or very close to Business 80.
I see. And I guess all of this expense was a big factor in the decision by the Sacramento Zoo to not move to Sutter's Landing Park. There is, as we mentioned earlier, a workshop on Sacramento Zoo and its future. Happens at Sacramento City Hall starting this afternoon at 2. Thanks to our guests in our studio, Scott Mendy, New Growth and Info Manager for the City of Sacramento. On the phone, Mary Healy, Director and CEO of the Sacramento Zoo, and J.P. Tyndall, Park Planning and Development Manager for the City of Sacramento. Thank you all so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, author Amy Bloom, her latest book is the acclaimed collection of short stories titled Where the God of Love Hangs Out. To Inside from Capital Public Radio, I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later today on Capital Public Radio News, on Lake Tahoe's West Shore, a ski resort's expansion plan is raising concerns. Also, how the Capital Corridor is shuffling resources to accommodate an ever-rising number of train passengers between Sacramento and the Bay Area. It must be helpful for a fiction writer to have insights into human character, so perhaps a psychotherapist would have extra insight. A former psychotherapist is now a well-known and acclaimed fiction writer, Amy Bloom, is in town tomorrow night with her latest book, the highly acclaimed collection of short stories titled Where the God of Love Hangs Out. She'll be speaking at the Crest Theater for California Lectures. Right now she's on the phone. Amy Bloom, welcome to Insight.
Well, thank you.
Well, when you were practicing psychotherapy, were you thinking to yourself when talking with people, you know, this would be an interesting character in a book?
No, I have to say I never was. I was a pretty good therapist, and I liked being a therapist, and so I don't think it ever occurred to me. Also, most of the time I was practicing, I didn't have any intention of being a writer.
Yes. How do you handle the fiction writer's need to find interesting new people for the book and interesting new stories for the book with your, I guess, your professional responsibilities to your former clients and their privacy?
Well, I suggest that people do things like go to the grocery store, you know, take a walk down the street,
yes.
Eavesdrop, go to a restaurant. The world is filled with interesting people, including your family and friends, who you can exploit without having to turn to, you know, therapy clients.
Yes. My guest is Amy Bloom, the author. Can you tell us how you became a psychotherapist and how you moved from that to being an author?
Well, I had started out as an actor and a director, which is the first job I had out of college. I was very lucky, and I was working with a small rep company in New York. And my sort of domestic life and my boyfriend and his son prompted me to move back to Connecticut, at which point I thought, oh, well, it's going to be a little hard to be on Broadway from here. And my other great interest was listening to people's stories. And so I went to graduate school in social work and opened a private practice and taught at Yale in the med school for altogether about 20 years. And the writing sort of came upon me. I used to say that it was as if you drive into a gas station, you know, the old-fashioned kind where they come out and they pump your gas, and there is this pimply, awkward kid, and suddenly you realize you have fallen madly in love and must leave everything behind and run off with him. And that's sort of how writing was. I didn't have any plans. It just came upon me.
Amy Bloom speaks tomorrow night in Sacramento for California Lectures. Your new book, or latest book, Where the God of Love Hangs Out, is such a poignant and powerful title. Where did it come from?
Well, the particular story that's the title of is about a father-in-law and a daughter-in-law who think that they have nothing in common and become friends over issues of love. And the bar that I pictured it taking place in is the kind of bar where, you know, it's not that somebody resides and it's not that somebody's having a cocktail. It's more like it's 2 o'clock and it's last call, and it turns out that's where the God of Love hangs out.
Mm. One of the other things you've done in your writing career was create and write for and executive produce a TV drama series called State of Mind that was on the Lifetime channel a few years ago. And on your website, you wrote, if I had to do it again, darker, funnier, sadder, and not so much background music. Could you tell us more about your experience of working for TV?
It was wonderful. I mean, it was really as if it was the Amy Bloom summer camp for learning how to make television. We had great actors. Our lead was Lily Taylor. We had a terrific Scottish actor named Derek Riddell, who's very successful in England. We just had wonderful people. And one of the things I learned, for example, is that even though the network executives explained to me that you had to have music all the time, otherwise the audience would become bored or not know how to feel, it seemed to me it was entirely possible that people watching the TV show were not idiots, and that we could use music more selectively rather than sort of blanketing the entire show. So things like that are the things that you learn by doing. And it was a wonderful opportunity for me. I enjoyed every minute of making that show, and I hope I get to do it again.
Well, I was just going to ask if you'd like to do it again. It sounds like you'd like to, but I guess it's one thing to want to do it. It's another thing to have the chance, given the budgets involved.
Well, given the budgets involved, and, you know, I do my part. I try to come up with good ideas. I go in and I pitch them to networks, and they usually say, go ahead and write a script. We'd like to explore the possibility. And sometimes it goes a little bit further, and sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, in TV, there's a lot of pitching, and there's not much doing, unfortunately, and there's not a ton of risk-taking, but nevertheless, it continues to be a really interesting playground to walk around in.
You know, another interesting thing I saw in your website was a thing called Life Lessons, and it was 10 life lessons that you wrote, and I particularly like the first one. Events reveal people's characters, they don't determine them, and then it goes on, not everyone with divorced parents has terrible relationships. And that really sounds like the author speaking there, as opposed to the stereotypical psychotherapist who thinks that everything comes from your parents.
No, these are very much, I mean, really what I had said to the people, I can't remember who asked for the article, but I said, these are things I wish somebody had persuaded me of earlier in my life. And it is certainly the case that what I see in the world is that after you're 10 years old, not much that happens makes you who you are. It just gives you a chance to show who you are. And sometimes that's good news, and sometimes it's not bad news. You know, it's not good news. But, you know, nevertheless, it is true that I think mostly we are revealed. And that also tends to be how I write. I'm much more interested in who the character shows themselves to be rather than some big transformative hoo-ha that takes place when somebody's 35 years old, which I have seen very rarely in my own life.
And how did you come to write those 10 life lessons?
I think somebody had asked me, I think it's a magazine essay, and I got to write, you know, about stuff that I feel strongly about. You know, for example, mean lasts forever. It's another one of those observations. It's like, you know, some people get better looking as they get old, and some people get crabbier, and some people get sweeter. But if you have somebody who is a mean SOB, they are likely to stay that way. And, you know, my advice, whether you're a man or a woman, is grab your coat and get out the door, because it's not going to get nicer.
And how much of those life lessons come from you as a former psychotherapist, and how much of it comes from you as a fiction writer who spends presumably a lot of time observing and thinking about people?
You know, the truth is I don't think it comes from either of those things. I think it comes from being, you know, a middle-aged woman who started raising kids when she was 21. You know, I mean, I've just been around for a long time, and these are the things you tend to notice.
You've written both short stories and novels, and I'm curious what the process is for deciding if this is what happens. You know, I think it's time for a book of short stories, or no, I think it's time for a novel.
Oh, I don't think anything on this earth would make me wake up and go, it's time for a novel. I mean, for me as a writer, that's like going, hey, it's time for the bubonic plague. You know, it's like, you know, that's never something I want to hear. Short story is always good news because I think it might be possible that I would live to finish it. They're both very demanding forms. I think it is very, very hard to write a great short story. It's easy to write a mediocre one, and the truth is it's hard to write even a mediocre novel. It still takes a lot out of you. It's one of the reasons I don't do reviews anymore, because the fun ones are the negative ones, and I just had come to feel like, you know what, even these lousy writers are working hard. I can't bear to criticize them in print.
But given your success in short stories, why bother writing any novels? Why not just write short stories?
Because I like novels. I like the bigger space. I like the bigger cave that you have to wander through. It's challenging and it's interesting, and I feel like I knew more about how to write a novel with my second novel than with my first one. And, you know, God willing, I'll know more about how to write a novel with my third one than with the second one.
And are you working in a third one?
Oh, yes, I am. I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound so downhearted about it. I mean, I love having written. It's just that the process itself is sort of like being a subsistence farmer.
Yes.
You know, you get up every day, you plow every day, you pray for rain, but not too much of it. And you know that there's a really good chance that it's not going to go well.
Amy Bloom, the author, her latest book is the short story collection Where the God of Love Hangs Out. She speaks tomorrow night in Sacramento at 7:30 at the Crest Theater for California Lectures. Amy Bloom, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's Insight for today. We'll be back tomorrow. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Our associate producers today, Lynn Weaver, Liz Cazares, and Sosin Marar. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. At Insight, we have one goal.
Wanting to get more insight.
To get the answers you want to hear.
That's a very good question.
Good to be here in the Culture Bunker.
It's interesting that you asked.
I'm glad you asked.
From interesting people of every stripe.
You really have delved into my deepest, darkest secrets.
What do you got to bring that up for?
It's kind of give you more of a deep, more serious insight.
Well, this could work.
I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.